My name is Mike and Malcolm.
Mike.
My sobriety date is August 13th in 1989. I have a sponsor and I have a home group. And if you hear nothing else from me tonight, those are the three most important things of to describe me. I have a date at which I know was my last drink. And I hope I never get as so arrogant as to think that that date can't change. Sadly, I know a great many people recently who have, for one reason or the other, convinced themselves that they can drink safely after like 20 plus years of sobriety. And I don't want to find that out. I had enough problems before I got here with drinking. I don't need any more. I caused myself enough on a daily basis sober. So I'd prefer not to find out, you know. I really have no desire to go back there. But I also am very clear that if I'm not here, I'm there. It's really that simple for me. Because this is the only place where I've ever found a connection to people that allow me to function in a world that I've never understood, that I've never felt comfortable in, and where I can like sit in my chair and just go, oh, and it's okay. I have a sponsor who I talk to regularly. I write him a letter a couple times a month. He lives out in California. And I'm accountable to him. I do the best I can to be transparent in my life and tell him the things that I'm doing or not doing, good, bad, or indifferent. My first sponsor I had for 20 years till he passed away. I've had this sponsor now for 7 years. Oh, my God. 7 years. Sometimes it feels like yesterday that my first sponsor passed away. And I have a home group that meets on Sunday nights, and people there know I'm here, so it makes it okay. And if I don't show up, there somebody eventually is like, you know, what are you doing? Where are you? And I never knew being accountable to a home group or to anybody had any value in my life, because I figured, you know, I live in America. I can do whatever I want. And that's true. I can. But depending on how I'm acting, some people might have some problems with that. And usually the police. I've been known to break out in handcuffs. And I wasn't real good at being bad, but I was more of a pain in the butt. As my sponsor explained to me when I did my fourth and fifth step, that's about as good as I got at being bad. But it was enough to, you know, trash my life. And, you know, I started drinking when I was 9 or 10 years old is when I had my first drink. But long before that, I the book talks about irritable, restless, and discontented. I just say I twitched. Okay? I never felt right. I was always a ready, fire, aim kind of kid. As far back as I can remember, my name should have been Trouble because I was always in trouble. When I was 5 or 6 years old, I got brought home to my mother by the police for throwing sticks and rocks at cars as they went by. And they caught me because one of them was a cop car. And, you know, and when I was little, and they've come back a little bit, but when I was little and people would put out Christmas lights, the bulbs were the really big ones, right? And when you would throw them and break them on a wall, they made a great pop. And I would do that, and I got caught for that. And I liked to play with matches, and I got caught for that. I just did things. I mean, I don't know about you, but I just did stuff. I just, you know, if it got into my head, and if I could get, you know, talk myself into it, I was doing it. And the only things I didn't do is I couldn't get past the fear. If I couldn't get past the fear, I wouldn't do it. But if I get past the fear of it, I'm doing it. And it didn't matter the consequence. It didn't matter how it affected you. I never in my life, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a good portion of my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never thought once, if I do this, I'm going to adversely affect someone. That's not how I thought. I never thought about you. You were not on my radar of life. I had no awareness of you other than, you know, if I saw you. But I didn't have a care or real concern for anyone. I only cared about myself. I was selfish and self-centered for as far back as I can remember. And the only time I really cared about anything or anybody was the 5 minutes before and after I got caught. Okay? And then I'd do the appropriate little puppy dog eyes, and I'm so sorry, da-da-da. And then the minute you turned your back, I'm doing the same stuff. Because like I say, you're not, people were not a part of my consciousness. They weren't a part of my awareness of life. So I'm just doing what I do, and I don't get it. I don't get why people get mad at me. Maybe later I kind of did, but I didn't get it then. I'm like, you know, I'm just having a good time. So like I said, at about 8 or 9 years old, I started drinking, and obviously at 8 or 9, I'm not getting booze every day. But I still remember the first drink that did anything for me. I told my parents, my sisters used to have their friends over, and it was the early 70s, so, you know, high school and teenage kids drinking was kind of, it seemed to me, normal anyway. And they usually had beer at the house, and I said, you know, I want a beer. And they were trying to get me to go to bed, and they finally said, if you go to bed, we'll give you a beer. Because I'm like, if you don't give me a beer, I'm telling Mom and Dad. And so they gave me a beer, and I drank the beer. And in the house I grew up on, you'd go up the steps, you go up one flight, and then it cuts back up on itself, and then my room was right there. And I don't know, I didn't know it then, but I know it now. From the very moment I took that drink, alcohol did something for me. Because I can remember it as clear as day, like right now. And I just went, oh. I didn't know I needed to go, oh. But I needed to go, you know, I needed to relax. And, you know, like I said, it's not like I just went, you know, at age 10 became a daily drinker and started, you know, breaking the law and doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, I was a little kid and I liked to do what little kids do. I liked to play sports. I wasn't a big fan of school, but, I'd go to school and, you know, try to do what I'm supposed to within reason, I guess. I mean, if it didn't get in the way of what I wanted to do, I tried to do what I was supposed to. And, and as a small child, I was diagnosed with hyperactivity and minimal brain dysfunction. That sounds so much better than ADD, whatever they call it now. And this has always amazed me. They put you on speed for that stuff. I don't understand that, you know. And because, like I said, I was a ready, fire, aim kind of kid. I mean, you would give me something, I'd start doing it, and then I would, like, walk away and go do something else. I just, my attention, you know. But that doesn't make me alcoholic. The fact that my parents were one of the first parents in the 70s to get a divorce on my block doesn't make me alcoholic. The fact that, you know, I got picked on pretty good as a kid doesn't make me alcoholic. The fact, you know, I can give you a bunch of, you know, the fact that I played with matches, or, you know, I didn't get, you know, whatever on Christmas, or, you know, my sister, you know, whatever my brain came up with, none of that stuff made me alcoholic. What made me alcoholic was the effect that alcohol has on me when I take a drink. What makes me alcoholic is what the book talks about. I can't drink safely. Because once I, at some point in my drinking, right, once I started, all bets were off. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know where the train was going to stop. I didn't know if I'm spending all the money, part of the rent money. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. And when I'm stopped, I can't tell you with any assurance that I'll stay stopped. I can't tell you when I'm going to start. But at some point, something's going to happen, and I'm going to start again. And the only thing that has ever in my life stopped that cycle is Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? And I went through, like I said, I started when I was 9 or 10. And by the time I was 15 years old, my father had had enough of me, of my lying and cheating and stealing. The neighbors had had enough of my lying and cheating and stealing. The police knew what I was up to, and they told the neighbors, we're going to catch him because we know what he's doing. The neighbors didn't really like it when they found out that I liked to break into houses. The cops didn't like it that I liked to sell drugs. And my dad didn't like it because he couldn't control me or do nothing with me. So I got arrested again because the things, I'm good at two things. I'm good at drinking. I'm good at getting arrested. I did it a lot. And I'd gotten arrested again. And the intake worker came down and said, what do you think we should do? And I knew my dad was done with me. I said, I think I probably should go to Michigan and live with my mom. So at age 15, I moved from Bethesda, Maryland. And for those who don't know what Bethesda, Maryland is, it's basically Never Never Land. Because it certainly isn't, you know, as I've come to know, it's certainly not a, you know, I don't want to put this. It's certainly not an example of, like, regular, everyday America to me, anyway. I've been enough places in this country to know that. And so I went from there, right? My dad was a government lawyer. I went to, you know, school, upper middle class community. There was no hardship in my life. And I moved from there to right outside of East Detroit, Michigan, in the late 70s and early 80s. And they were closing factories daily. People were getting laid off by the tens of thousands in the auto industries. Coal communities were dying because the steel mill would pull out or the stamping factory or whatever it was. They would just die. Okay? I was in a community that was not just white, and I hadn't experienced that in my life. And I got there, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I couldn't hardly say six words to people. There was so much fear. Okay? And there wasn't even, like, back to the awareness of my selfishness, there wasn't even an awareness of how my actions leading up to being 15 affected my mother as being her youngest and only son. All I cared about was, I don't know how to deal with this place. I don't know what to do. These people scare me. I was in an environment that was so far removed from what I had spent most of my life in. It was shocking to me. Okay? So I do what I do. I ask somebody, hey, you want to get high? And that's how I made friends. And I found where the drugs were. I found where the booze was. And I'm very aware this is an AA meeting. So I'll keep my references to drugs minimal. But it is part of what I do. Okay? And so that's what I did. I'm one of these children who, though you could say I had potential, and you could say I have a brain, I managed to get through public education unscarred by education. Okay? Which sounds cute. If I had one thing to do over again in my life, I'd have gotten my education. I got through school because I have just natural ability to, like, learn just enough to take the test, to get just enough of a grade to get out. And that's what I did. Okay? And when I was up there, I learned new levels of fear. I learned neat little things like when you're walking down the street and you think somebody's following you, you better turn around and look because somebody probably is. Okay? It was just a whole different world. And eventually, if you're in some place long enough, you learn how to adapt. And I adapted through booze and drugs. And I made, you know, friends or as much friends as I was making at that age, you know. And but I just, it was, excuse me, again, it was, the story of my life up to AA, and like I said, a great deal of my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, is me going through life without any concern for you, without any real awareness of you, unless you had something I wanted or needed. That is the story of my life. I could have been in, like I said, outside East Detroit, Michigan, in Bethesda. I could have been right smack dab in the middle of Canarita, Kansas, where my dad's family's from. All right? It wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have changed my perception of life. It just would have been first the shock of where I am and then figuring out how to get what I need to deal with it with no care or concern for you. And the book says my problem basically is I'm selfish and self-centered. And I have no ability to form a true partnership with another human being. And when I look back on my life, it's completely 100% crystal clear. And it's the same problem I have today. It's not like that problem has changed in 53 years of living and 27 years of being in AA. That's still my problem. It's my joke with my sponsor. He says, how you doing? I'm like, when I'm with people, I'm fine. And if I'm not with them enough, I'm not fine. It's that simple in my life. Okay? When I'm here with you doing these things, the book says the problem's removed, and my problem's been removed because I've made the amends. I've taken the steps. I've done the things I was asked to do around here, and I continue to try and do them, and the problem has been removed. I have found a power greater than myself that removes my problem, that has removed my problem. All right? And it tells me in the book, and we agnostics, it says quite clearly, the whole purpose of this book, right, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. That's it. If you have what I have and you do these things in this book, your problem will be solved. And I don't care what you call your higher power. I'm one of them guys. All right? And for those who are, you know, have problems with that, read the book, because there's a line in the book that says basically, when they use the word God in this book, it's used as a descriptor, not as a noun. Okay? And thank God it was. Because when I got here and you talked about God, I wanted to beat your head in. I wanted no parts of God. Okay? That's what I was like, no, no, no. My mom wanted me to be a priest, and I'm like, no, no, no. You know. So, like I said, I ran around, I went to Michigan, did, you know, I drank. That's what I did. I drank and got in trouble. Really, is the story of my life. After high school, I was supposed to go to college. I found this little college in Vermont I was going to go to, and then in August of 81, my mom and me and my stepdad, we came down to Washington. My oldest sister was getting ready to move to California. We came down to see her. The drinking age in Michigan was 21. The drinking age in Maryland was 18. Got grandfathered in. And I went and found my buddy. Three cases of beer later, we're on the Bay Bridge, headed to Ocean City. I called my mom the next day. She says, where are you? I go, Ocean City. She says, we're leaving tomorrow, so you better be here. I'm like, okay. I did not get back tomorrow, even though I did hitchhike from Ocean City to Bethesda, then spent the night at my younger sister's house, got up, walked out to the Beltway, and hitchhiked back to Detroit, Michigan. And I did that a bunch. I never did see my sister before she left for California. I took a drink, the drink took me, and we're off to the races. It's that simple. Okay? And I got home, and it's August of 81. The college I was supposed to go to starts, their semesters start, their trimesters, and they started in October. And I'm supposed to be in Vermont on October 1 of 81. I got home, went to sleep, woke up the next day, walked into the dining room, looked at my mom, said, I'm moving. I packed up my Ford LTD with everything I owned and drove it to the nearest parking lot in Bethesda, Maryland, and started drinking. And one night we started playing demolition derby with my house. My house lost, and I found a Ford LTD wagon, and I put illegal plates on it. The cops caught me, took my plates, and I needed a place to park it, and my dad allowed me to park it in his driveway, and my Ford LTD wagon became my home in my father's driveway. My father was sober at that point about 8 or 9 months, and he probably had a good sponsor because the sponsor probably said, do not let that little blankety-blank in your house, because I didn't care about his sobriety. My school called my father's house and said, hey, are you coming? And I'm like, I don't think so. I'm in my house, in my dad's driveway. Okay? And needless to say, I did not make it. And I was 18 years old, and I'm full-blown alcoholic. All I care about is drinking and running around, having a good time. I don't care about you. And by the time, you know, that following winter, my father's birthday is in January. January of that year, we went and my dad's birthday, and it was a good night. And he asked me, my birthday is about a month after my dad's. And he said, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I said, I don't know. We'll figure something out. Told him I loved him. And those are the last words I ever spoke to my father. On my 19th birthday, my father was in the intensive care unit of a suburban hospital. He had had an aneurysm. I think he ended up dying of complications from alcoholism. I think his body just didn't have one more battle in him, even though he was sober. My dad died sober. And the day he passed away, my dad was a lawyer, he's a very intelligent guy. But he, you know, the loss of blood and strokes and everything that went on, the doctors, and they said there'd probably be major brain damage. So my sisters and I made the decision to turn off the machines. And I'm standing there. I asked the nurse how long, and they go about a minute. I lasted maybe 30 seconds before I stormed out of the hospital room. And at a time when you're supposed to be there with your family and taking care of one another and looking out for one another when you lose your father, they got to worry about me because I just can't take it. I got to go take a drink. That was a Friday night, and I had some people say, don't drink, drink this away. That night I did not, but for the next 18 months I did. I inherited close to $100,000 in less than a year that went up my nose, down my throat, or to restitution or lawyers. By the end of that time, I was looking at 2.5 years in prison for basically just being a little punk kid. I had a friend who said, you should go to jail, it'll make you a man. I'm thinking, I'm not so sure about that. I was under no illusions of how tough I was. And this is like 83, 84-ish. And it was like at the beginning of HBO, and I'm in the living room doing bong hits and drinking, and you know at 2 a.m. they have, do you have a problem with drugs and alcohol? And I go, no, you know, right? Laughing. 2 weeks later, I called that number. And I ended up in a long-term rehab because I went there because I didn't want to go to jail. That's why I went. And I never really got completely honest with that, even though I made it through that program. I had enough charges over my head and had done enough things that it kind of kept me there. But I never really got honest about the fact. I was just there trying to play the system, really. But it's the only other time in my life besides being in AA where I stayed sober and had some level of comfortability. And what I know now is the reason for that is that I was with people and we were all trying to do the same thing and there was a connection between us that allowed us to, that allowed me to connect and be okay. I stayed there for 18 months, graduated, finally went to that school in Vermont after that. Some of the teachers there remembered me. They're like, oh, you finally made it, you know, like 3-4 years later, right? And I think I was 21 at that time. And I was sober, stark, raving, sober, freshly out of an 18-month facility. And the long and short of that little experience is the first winter or first up to the first winter, I would go to the local general store, and I'd get like $10 in quarters. And I'd fill the payphone up with quarters and call back to the house that I was in, the rehab. And I would talk to people there. And it would keep me on the planet. Because I didn't want to go to AA. My dad had gone to AA. My sister was in AA. I thought you people were weird. We are. It's okay. As you talk about going to 15,000 meetings a week and all this stuff, and I'm like, no. Here's what was real. You scared the hell out of me. Excuse me. You scared me. And I had been to AA when I was like, 18, 19 years old. And I met, I tried to go to a meeting one day on a Sunday, and I got there late like a good newcomer. And I looked, and it had, those half doors, half window, half solid, right? And it was a room in this clubhouse, and the room was packed, and I looked in, and they're all kind of my age. I didn't have the power to walk through that door. I couldn't do it, so I left. And, I was afraid, and, I just wouldn't go to AA. I didn't have the power to go to AA. And eventually, my calling back to, the rehab slowed down. My best friends from rehab all drank. And eventually I stopped being in contact with them. So at that point, I got no contact with anything. And the restless irritability and discontentedness starts back. And I came back to Washington that summer to work and do some things. And I start running with the same people. And eventually, if you run with the same people, you're going to do what they do. I'd like to stand here and say, I didn't rob banks because I was a good guy. I'll tell you why I didn't rob banks. I didn't run around with people who rob banks. It's that simple. I never put a needle in my arm, not because I didn't want to put needles in my arm, which I really kind of didn't. But I wouldn't run around with people who put needles in their arm. There's no virtue in the things I didn't do. I just wasn't exposed to them. Okay? And what happened is I'm running around with this guy, and he starts selling drugs, so I start doing them eventually. And then I go back to school for 8-9 months, and I stay sober, and I move back to Michigan, and I'm working, and I'm busy, and I meet this girl, and we go on a date, and she says, I want some wine coolers. And I go, yeah, so do I. Like, I need one. And that started the three longest years of my life. And what happened is what always happens. I build up, you know, by then I had some education. I learned how to work a little bit. I can show up a little bit. And I moved back to Washington, and things look good. But my second night in town, I go into a blackout and, you know, just about get kicked out of where I'm living because I don't like the guy yelling at his wife. And I tell him about it, and he's about ready to throw me out of the house. And we patched that up, but I've already blacked out and drank up all the money. And I ain't even been there, you know, 48 hours. And by the end, I was sitting in my house, drinking and doing what I always do with a friend of mine. He asked me how I was doing. I said, I'm great. I was dying. I was dying on the inside. And that was August the 12th of 1989. In November of 88, I had my boss and I had gone down to Woodbridge to pick up his vehicle. We'd been drinking all afternoon. We hit every single bar there was in Woodbridge on Route 1 coming out of Woodbridge. And eventually I got pulled over. And I had a fun little ride from Woodbridge to Manassas for the jail. And I got sent to ASAP, the long version. My lawyer said, no, we're not taking you to Fairfax County because they'll put you in long-term treatment, which I was happy with because I didn't want to go back to long-term treatment. But I live now quite close to where I lived then, right in Rockville, and Manassas is kind of far from Rockville. And so every Thursday night for 17 weeks, I had to drive from Rockville to Manassas, and as usual, they were doing construction on 66. And it was awful. I hated it. And, you know, you do the intake on these things, and they go, you know, we suggest, you know, you should stop drinking for 17 weeks. I take it as a suggestion. But I did hear something very clear. They're like, you know, you could get a random breathalyzer at this place, right? Or a random blood test. So my brain goes, no drinking on Thursdays. And you know how at these things, about halfway through, they do the little eval to see how you're doing. And the guy goes, you stopped drinking? I said, no, you didn't say I had to stop drinking. You just said no drinking on Thursdays. And he goes, well, if you, and I saw no reason, there was no upside to lying to this guy. I'm like, whatever, I don't care. And he says, well, if you don't stop drinking for the next 6 weeks, I got to send you back to court. Now I'm pissed, but I'm not mad at him because he's just doing his job. I'm mad because I know there's no way on God's green earth I can stop drinking for 6 weeks. I'm 26 years old at that point. There's no way. And I believe, even though I didn't stay sober from that night to this, right? I believe at that moment, I surrendered to the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. Though at that time, I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't know that's what was going on, but I believe that's what happened. So 2 or 3 weeks later, when I'm, you know, with my buddy on a Saturday night, August the 12th of 89, something happened. Because I went to bed that night. And I went to bed drunk and high, and I woke up the next day, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can assure you, when I went to bed that night, I wasn't thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I might have been thinking about, I got all these court slips to get signed, and I don't know when I'm going to get them signed, and I'm not one of, I never thought I could just sign them myself, as my current sponsor explains to people on court slips. But I wasn't thinking about AA that morning, or certainly not when I went to bed. And that night, it was a Sunday night, I went to a meeting at a place called Del Rey Club in Bethesda. And the meeting was on willingness, and somewhere in my demented brain, I knew if I could be willing long enough, I had a shot at this thing, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't know I was looking at the thing that I'd sold my soul for. Hey, alcohol never took anything from me. I gave it all up gladly for another drink. And if you'd have told me that night that 27 years later I'd still be here and I'd be sober, I'd have probably ran out of that room screaming to the nearest bar. It wasn't on my list of things to do. You know, I joke with people. Really, all I ever wanted to do in my life is this. I wanted to drink beer with my friends, work on cars, and barbecue. That's all I really wanted to do. Maybe play a little baseball or football or something, but that's about it. Problem is, I start drinking and I start wandering around. And things happen. And then I don't come home till 4 in the morning, and you got to kind of get up and go to work the next day, and I'm not one of those who... I don't understand you people who drink till 4 in the morning, get up 2 hours later and go to... I do not understand you, because I am not one of them. Right? I don't make it to work the next day. You know? And so I start this journey in AA, and I don't know what's going on here. I'm terrified. And if you're anything like me, when I'm terrified, I growl at people, right? I'm not friendly. I'm not like, it's not me. I kind of look at you like, go ahead, I dare you to come over here and say something, right? I can still be that way today, ask my friends. And I'm at this Sunday night meeting, and the guy I had, like I said, I had court slips. Guy next to me is on court slip, so we sign each other's court slip. And I only bring him up because for like the next 6 years, I would see him at that clubhouse. I hope he's still sober. I don't know if he is, but for like the next 6 years, I would see him there. And it would always make me smile. And like I said, I had these court slips, and I started doing the math, and I'm like, there's not enough days to get all these court slips signed. So the unthinkable's happening, and I'm going to have to go to 2 on the weekends. I'm like, this is just a bad turn of events. But I don't want to go to court, so I'm going to do it. And somewhere, I don't know if this was that week or the next week, I went to a Tuesday meeting. And it's a meeting I had been to before on my different visits to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a young people's meeting in Kensington. And a guy did to me what I'm sure you guys do all the time in this meeting. When you see somebody you don't know, they said hello. And instead of growling at the guy, I said hello back. And I got a one-day chip. And the guy said, look, I'll do whatever it takes to help you stay sober. And I don't know why I believed the guy, but I did. I didn't know him. Why would I believe him? I don't know this guy, but I did. And he said, look, you know, what are you doing Wednesday and Thursday? And I actually had legitimate things Wednesday and Thursday. Most newcomers don't, but I did. Thursday, I had to drive to Manassas still. Wednesday, I actually had something. And he said, well, meet me Friday night at this meeting in the same area. And I said, okay. And I get there, and it was the room was about half this size with about 4 times this many people in it. It was a smoking meeting. It was great. And but the guy who said be there wasn't there, so I was a little grumpy about that. That's a theme of my story. I was always a little grumpy. And but I remember sharing that night, and I can still remember I was like in the back, and people turned around to listen to me share, and I can still remember the shine of the people and the brightness of them as they were listening to me share, and it stayed with me 20 some years later. Just something about it got in. And a guy I was supposed to meet, he showed up, and we went out in front of the church after the meeting. There's, you know, a few hundred people out there, and he says, go make friends, pushes me into the crowd, and I'm like, I'm not good at let's go make friends at 27 years sober. So at like 7 days sober, we're not real good at let's go make friends. But I did the best I could, and then, you know, they take me to IHOP. I'm like, really? We're going to IHOP? Oh, my God. It just seems so awful. And then the next night we went to McDonald's. And it was August, so I had the county fair in Montgomery County. And this girl who's still sober, who I love dearly, she says, look, we really do have a lot of fun around here. We don't just sit in the McDonald's. And she was right. About a month into my sobriety, they have a housewarming party. And my sponsor goes, and that guy who introduced himself, his name was Bill. He was my very first sponsor. I had him for like 6 months before I got the man who was to be my sponsor for the next 20 years. And he said, we're going to the housewarming party. I'm like, you may be, I'm not, right? I'm like, what, huh? Housewarming party? What are you talking about? Well, I'm like, okay, I get in the car. It's a story of my sobriety. I get in the car. And there's this older guy who, I'd seen him at the meetings, and he kind of looked like AA's bouncer. And he actually had been a bouncer at the local, at the local bars, but not bar, other bar. But he was sitting, you know, around a bunch of people, and he said, look, you're kind of special. I don't do this often. I'll give you my phone number. And I bought it. Because it took me 2 years to realize he'd give his phone number to anybody who asked him. But here's the trick. I never would have asked. Ever. See, and I never would have asked God to get me sober because I didn't. I did not. The night I went to sleep and then got up the next day and ended up in AA, I can assure you there was no prayer asking a God to keep me sober. Now, I have asked God plenty of times since I've been here to keep me sober. But I never asked God to help get me sober. All right? God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because I never would have asked. I didn't want to be sober. I cannot stress that enough to you. I wanted no parts of sobriety. None. Especially, I wanted some fellowship, but I didn't want to have to work real hard at it. Okay? I wanted the benefits of fellowship, but I didn't want to have to work real hard at it. I wanted some of these things, but I didn't want to have to do anything to get them. Alright? My sponsor would call that narcissism, I believe is the term he would use. And certainly arrogant and self-centered. So I met this man, and at about 6 months sober, he became my sponsor, and the first two things he said to me is, I want your four-step and I want you to quit coaching. And at that time, I coached Little League baseball and football. And I was a little huffy about that because coaching was about the only thing I thought I did that had any value in the world. But I did what he asked me to do for some reason. And the day that I called the people that I coached for, I said, look, I gotta take a break from this. I went into where my sponsor worked and I said, I did what she asked, and I basically said, who the blank do you think you are, God? And he goes, no, I wouldn't want your will. And it was a long time before I realized he had insulted me. And but we sat down in a booth, and he said, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take your will for you and my will for you, and we're going to figure something out. I can assure you in the next 20 years, he never listened to my will for me. Ever. And thank God he didn't. And that man, his name was Frank, and he took a little scared little kid who was 26 years old and taught me how to be a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he taught me how to have a care for another human being. And he taught me how to have some awareness for the fact that there were other people on the planet. And he took me through the steps, and other than, when he had me do my fourth and fifth step, it wasn't do the steps or die. He kind of weaved them into my life through the things we did when we were together. I'd have things going on after my fourth and fifth step, and he'd be like, you're getting ready. You're getting ready. I'm thinking, getting ready for what? Hit you in the head with a chair? Because you won't give me a straight answer? And I was just a wonderful newcomer. and really, I was just scared. Really, that's all it was. And what I was getting ready for, I was getting ready to ask some power I didn't believe in for help. I was getting ready to change my mind about a lot of things and ask him what to do. Instead of being ready, fire, aim, I was getting ready to, like, see a situation, and before I jumped in it, I might pick up the phone and call him and go, what do you think? What do you think I should do? And then if we got really lucky, I might actually do what he said to do, but that took a little longer. Okay? That's what I was getting ready to do. I was getting ready to open my mind up to a whole new way of living that I knew nothing about. A way of living that goes kind of like this. Most of my life, I was a taker of things, a user of people. Therefore, I am a loser. My sponsor taught me how to think about others. He taught me the concept of hooray for you and hooray for me. And my first attempts at that was like learning to cook for people, getting somebody a cup of coffee. I remember when I first saw somebody ask their sponsor, you want a cup of coffee? I'm like, I'm not doing that. And then I just realized it was just being polite and learning how to just give for the sake of giving. And I learned little things like just do something for somebody and don't tell nobody about it. Just do it. But my sponsor lived these things. And like I said, he weaved them in and out of my life. I mean, I was blessed that I got to spend so much time with my sponsor. I was always with him. Because I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't a big let's go make friends. I wasn't a big follow the crowd kind of guy. He really had to work with me with when everybody zigs, you zig. When everybody zags, you zag. Not the opposite. When they go to the beach, you go to the beach, not the mountains. I mean, it took some effort from him to get me to, like, kind of go along with this and be willing to, like, kind of trust you a little bit and get near you, because I just was so terrified, and I still can be. I'm not. It's just not how I'm made up. I find it very difficult to be close to people or to allow people very close to me. It's just always been hard for me. And that's not an excuse. It's just the facts. I try to be better each day. But he taught me these things. And like I said, a lot of it was through practical, very practical things. Going to the meetings and setting up the meetings and making coffee. And we used to have beach houses. And, you know, I came to love cooking for people. And, you know, I'd collect money from people and go buy the food and make these dinners for people, and it just made my day. Now, on a side note, it meant I didn't have to talk to you as much because I was in the kitchen cooking. But, you know, but I could acknowledge that fact. I knew that's what, you know. But it allowed me to start to think of you, and it allowed me to learn things and do things for other people so that when I went to bed at night, I would go to sleep. Because I don't know about you, but I didn't sleep real well. Now I sleep just fine. Okay? When my head hits the pillow, I'm usually out pretty quick. And if I'm not, I'm pretty sure I usually know why, and I take care of it as soon as I can. You know, and he had me write my amends and my A-step list and make my amends, and I did those things. And I remember looking at the nice stuff going, oh, no. No. I got away with that stuff. Why am I going to go, no. We're not, no. But I did my amends, and I was able to, when my mother passed away, everything was clean. I was there when she had her last brain surgery that turned out the tumor was cancerous. I was able to care for my mother and do the things that grown men do. And I'd lived most of my life not thinking I was a grown man, and that was the one time I know for sure I did what men do. Because I grew up with John Wayne and Clint Eastwood, and I'm like, I won't ever be them. You know, I knew I didn't measure up. And in that moment of time, about 10 years sober, I was able to take care of my mom and do, like I said, what men do. You take care of your mother, you bathe her, and you do the deal. And I was able to do that. And I had a stepfather who I was close to. He was my stepfather for 30 years. He was married to my mother for 20, and after my mom died, I stopped talking to him because I was so mad at him for leaving my mom. I just was mad at him. And I was probably, come on, brain work, like 14, 15 years sober. And I wanted to go see my mom's grave. And I wasn't sure where. I knew kind of where it was, but I had to send him an email and ask him where it was. And I said, look, if you want to see me, this is where I'm going to be. just arrogant and ungrateful, kind of obnoxious. And he said, yeah, absolutely, I want to see you. And he lived 4 hours north of where I was going. He lived in northern Michigan at that time. I was going to outside Detroit. It's where my mom's buried. And in between the time I sent that email and I got there, it occurred to me that man had done what he promised my mommy would do when I was 10 years old when my mom moved away to be with him. He had promised my mom he'd try to take care of her kids as best he could, as much as, you know, he could. And I came to understand that he had tried to take care of me as much as I would let him for 30 years. And that he had always tried to do good by me. And when he picked my now ex-wife and I up from the hotel, I told him that. That, you know, he'd done good by me, really. And I was sorry for how I'd acted. And he lived another 5 years, and over those 5 years, him and I, we talked every month. I'd go see him, and we were as close as could be. And, so again, there was nothing there when he passed. I was able to be there at the end. I was able to go up to Michigan and see him and just be there, just be a son. My dad died when I was 19, so my dad never saw me when I was sober. So I was able to do for my stepfather what I wasn't able to do for my father. I was able to be there and nobody had to worry about me like they did when my father passed away. And none of these things would ever have happened without Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been blessed beyond my sponsor. As I said, I had my sponsor for 20 years and he taught me everything, and he passed away suddenly when I was 20 years sober. And then a year later, my now ex-wife decided she didn't want to be married. And the last 5-6 years, I've done some things I'm not overly proud of. But the thing that has saved me has been the fact that I have always stayed active and committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that I've never tried to defend the mistakes I've made. Make mistakes, please. You're going to. Just don't defend them. Live your life. Be sober. Have a good time. Try and help somebody. And if you can't help somebody, don't hurt anybody. You know? And like I said, I've made a ton of mistakes. But the ones I haven't made, I've never left AA. And by the grace of the loving God, I haven't had to drink. And my current sponsor, bless his heart, thank God for this. My first sponsor and current sponsor beat this into us. And it's the greatest compliment I've ever been given. I have a friend who celebrated, I don't know, like 15 years recently. And I sent him a note, said congratulations. And his reply back was, thank you and thanks for not being one of those who gets yours and leaves. It's the best compliment I've ever been given in my life. Because my sponsor has always been about hooray for you and hooray for me. My sponsor was in the meeting when I got there. So what would it say about what he taught me if I was no longer in the meeting for the next person coming in? Okay. Much has been given, much is owed. I owe more than I can ever pay back. And the easiest, most simplest way I can pay it back is by coming and having my dumb butt in the meeting. I didn't want to go last night. I was grumpy about it last night. It was cold. I didn't want to go. Knew I needed to go, but I still didn't want to go. But I got there. I got in the car. Like Pavlov's dog, get in the car. Get in the car. Get in the car. You know. And I've had a lot of fun in AA. I've been able to go places in Alcoholics Anonymous and do things with AA that were beyond my ability to do. The last 3 years, I've gotten to see the world as a result of my job. Places I never thought I would go. I've gotten to go to Russia and Cuba and, you know, Europe. And I spent my 51st birthday in the Serengeti Plain in Africa looking at lions and tigers and bears, you know. And I still can remember, I'm like, this is not my life. There's no way. A drunk from Bethesda, please. I couldn't even get out of the basement. But I didn't do it. God did it. AA did it. I didn't bury my mother. AA buried my mother. It's not my house. It's AA's house. It's not my car. It's AA's car. It's not my job. It's AA's job. Because every single thing that's good and decent in my life is a direct result of a God I did not believe in. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and people taking the time to teach me how to act. and people taking the time to encourage me to show up and do what I'm supposed to do, no matter how mundane and boring that may appear to me. And as a matter of fact, they insisted on it. My first sponsor used to tell me all the time, you will settle for seventh best. He never allowed that. He never allowed me to settle. Even when I was determined to settle, he never allowed it. He was like, only the best for you. And thank God. Thank God he did that. And thank God that there was people like you who were in the meeting when I got here and knew that I was just scared and didn't know what to do. And would just pat me on the head and say, keep coming back, it'll be all right. Even when it didn't feel all right. Because it was all right. So thank you very much for having me. Thank you for listening. And that's it.